Hello, welcome to our video on website maintenance and administration. This is video 4 in our series on our Community Information Toolkit. In today's video, we're going to go over the following topics. We're going to talk about choosing a home for your website. Do you want to put this site on your own server or on someone else's? Then we'll talk about organizing and building your site. Then we'll talk about issues involved in running your own server, should you choose to do so. Next, we'll talk about system administration, and we'll have a case study involving a library that does, in fact, run their own server, and then we'll finally conclude. Choosing a home for your website. Well, this is a very basic choice. Are you going to run your own server, or are you going to put your content on someone else's server? And this is the most critical choice you face in building your website. Let's look at some reasons why you might not want to run your own server. First off, it costs money. You're going to have to make a capital investment. Server hardware can cost real money. Next, you're going to need several kinds of expertise. You're going to have to know about operating system maintenance, server software maintenance, and then you're going to have to know about providing content provider support. You're going to have to help the people that are putting content onto your site. This involves defining new users, setting permissions, and a little bit of software maintenance. Finally, you're going to face some daily chores, such as backup. If you're not backing up your server, you're not doing your job. And all of these different kinds of work are going to be involved in maintaining your own service. What are some alternatives to running your own server? Well, you can make a deal with a partner, somebody who already has a server up and running. They may offer you space for free, as a matter of fact, somebody in your community or elsewhere that's willing to be your partner. Or you can rent space from a service provider. This might be in the case of a library or a local library cooperative. It might be a local or national commercial internet service provider, or ISP. Or in the state of Michigan, you might want to contact MERED, which is a statewide service provider that focuses on institutions such as libraries and educational institutions. So those are some alternatives to running your own server. When do you want to run your own server, Chuck?
Well, I think the most important thing that an organization to decide yes that they're going to run their own server, they really have to want to deal with technology. They need to enjoy that, and they need to enjoy learning about technology, because nothing stays the same. And they're going to end up with books on their shelf, you know, NT hardware compatibility book, the NT resource guide. They're going to have a stack of CD-ROMs, and they're going to spend a Saturday morning once in a while putting those CD-ROMs into their computers. And if that's not something that this people in this organization are going to enjoy, then they got to avoid that. I think it's very critical that they like the idea of technology.
And even if you get over that hurdle once, the technology won't stand still.
Absolutely.
You're going to be reinstalling operating systems, yep. Server environments.
There'll be a service pack that comes out that you need to patch some security hole or whatever.
Got to worry about security, performance, reliability, backup.
And I think the biggest thing that people are going to make a mistake is if they think they can get this thing put together and not look at the long term. I'll give you one sort of bad example. You have a 15-year-old student, high school student, who's a volunteer, and they're going to work all night, they're going to be free, they don't cost you any money, and they seem to know everything there is to know about computers, and they probably do. The problem is that high school student's going to graduate from high school and move 2,000 miles away and go to college and leave, and you're going to be stuck finding somebody for $35,000 or $40,000 to do that same work that was been done for free. And that's a kind of a not looking at the long term. I mean, you can solve the short term, but you can't solve the long term. So they got to have a strategy.
Now, it sounds like we're saying nobody should run their own server, and that's not what we're saying at all. We're saying understand the costs, understand the challenges, and if you're willing to make the investment, and if you see the payoff of controlling your own environment, fine.
Well, and also, I think there's another thing, and that is if the organization is moving in a general technology direction, like if you're putting computers on everybody's desks, and you're putting a LAN up for printing, and you're wiring for other reasons, then adding a web server is not as much pain as if you say, I don't have any technology at all in these buildings, and I'm going to put a web server in, because now you're sort of like oil and water, and it doesn't work so well. So it really needs to fit into the overall strategy of the organization.
But if it doesn't fit into that strategy, then you can concentrate on content, and after all, content's what it's all about. Now let's talk about organizing and building your site. First, we'll go over considerations involving the domain name system. Then we'll talk about organizing your file system. And we'll conclude this segment with a discussion of databases and integrated publishing environments. So let's talk about getting your own domain. As you surf the internet, you may discover a pattern in how hosts are named. They're named within various domains. NASA.gov, MSU.edu, AOL.com. Each of these is an internet domain. Now let's say you're the town of Smallville, somewhere in Michigan. You might want to go and get smallville.mi.us for your domain. Once you've done this, you are then free to create other host names within that domain, such as www.smallville.mi.us. How do you get one of these domains? First off, your institution may already have one. Perhaps years ago they went and got a domain. In this case, when you go to put a host up in the domain, all you need to do is talk to your own domain administrator. Now, if you don't have a domain and you want one of the forms, smallville.mi.us, in the state of Michigan, contact Merit. Merit is known as the administrator of the mi.us domain, and therefore they are the folks that will go and give you your own address within that space. If you want a domain such as smallville.org or smallville.com, which is perfectly viable, then go to the Internic, www.internic.net, and there you can go and register one of these domains. Now, when you get into server administration, you're going to have to understand the distinction between domain names and IP addresses. Fortunately, most users of today's internet don't have to worry about this, but if you're going to be an administrator, you will have to think about it a little bit. Every host on the internet is assigned a domain-style host name, such as jpl.nasa.gov, but also sort of under the covers, it's also assigned a numeric four-part IP address, for instance, 137.78.160.21. And this numeric IP address corresponds to the friendlier domain name that you see here. Now, the folks that have to deal with this are people who are administering systems or the domain administrators for an entire domain, such as smallville.mi.us. So you need to get together with your domain administrator, pick a name for the host you're going to be putting up, and that person will help you assign an IP address, and that will be permanently configured with that host. Now, when you get into the business of putting up documents on the web, you're going to be putting them on a server somewhere, whether it's your own server or somebody else's. So you're going to physically store HTML documents on a web server. We'll talk more in a minute about what it looks like to put those files on the server. Those documents are going to be delivered across the internet according to the rules of the Hypertext Transfer Protocol, or HTTP. On your server, you're going to be running some software that knows how to speak this protocol. Your customers on the other side are going to be using a web browser, and that web browser will understand not only HTTP in order to fetch a document, but also HTML in order to display it. And this is the basic model, which is sometimes referred to as the client-server model. And you, of course, are going to be worried about the server side. Now, typically, your server is going to be directly connected to the internet. Whether you own the server or whether somebody else runs it on your behalf, it needs some sort of direct internet connection, usually at a fairly high speed. A bare minimum would be at least 56 kilobits a second. More likely, it might be a T1 line or some similar more than 1 megabit a second kind of a connection. Once you're connected to the greater internet, your users may come in over a whole variety of paths. They may be dial-up users, they may be directly connected, and you don't worry about that so much. It's their problem to be connected in their own fashion. You just worry about getting your server installed and getting it connected to the internet. Now, in some cases, when you want to go and use somebody else as your sort of server environment, you may want to take advantage of what's called a virtual host Now, the virtual host concept allows a single physical server to own multiple domain names. In other words, multiple organizations can share one physical server box. Thus, smallville.mi.us and bigtown.mi.us could be running on one server, and the users of both web presences won't know the difference. And if you do decide to rent space from somebody else, you might want to investigate the virtual host mechanism as a way to make it look like you actually have a real physical host. Whether you're going to run your own server or whether you're going to be on somebody else's, you're going to be putting up stuff on your web server, and your users are going to refer to your documents, to your content, by a uniform resource locator or URL. What do these things look like? Well, they're pretty familiar. They begin with http://, and then some other stuff. And most of the URLs that your actual customers will type in will begin with this. In some cases, some users may be going off to other kinds of servers, such as FTP servers, but for our purposes today, we're not worried about that. Well, what is this URL all about? Well, the first part, http://, simply says that it's the web protocol. And increasingly, you find that people don't specify this, because web browsers are now smart enough to see that when you type www.smallville.gov, well, they'll just assume that it's a web address, and they'll put the http://, in for you. So www.smallville.gov is a server address, and that's really a domain-style host name that corresponds either to a real physical server or a virtual host. Now, finally, and optionally in a URL, we might have, after the server address, a path to a specific document on that server, such as /events.html. Now, let's say you're getting into the business of being a web server administrator. What does it look like when you put files on your server? You're going to have some sort of a starting point, like /home/webdata. And within that starting point, you're going to have the entire hierarchy of documents that belong to your web presence. Now, at every level in the hierarchy, you're going to want to have a starting document. And for a Unix server, that starting document would have a name, index.html. For other environments, this will be different. For instance, for a Windows-based server, it might look like default.htm. But at every level in the hierarchy, you will have this file. And in this case, for www.smallville.mi.us, index.html is the very first page, the very initial page or home page for the entire web presence. Now, you can organize your file system into a hierarchy, and in fact, this is almost mandatory so that you can keep up with what goes where. And so in your root, under web data, you'll have an index file and perhaps an image file or two. But you're going to want to break things apart into different topic areas. So topic one will have its own index.html file. It might have some picture files that go along with that index file, and then other topic files, other image files, and so forth. So what you're going to do is you're going to take your entire web presence and you're going to build a hierarchical tree structure. Now, your customers coming in may not see that tree structure exactly the way you've got it laid out on your hard disk, but the names that you pick and sort of the order and depth of the hierarchy that you organize will determine what those URLs are going to look like. So if you are the kind of person that organizes things by going into topic and subtopic and subtopic and subtopic, you're going to find that your URLs are going to get very long, and that's going to be confusing for users. If you're the kind of person like me that doesn't organize things very well and you put everything in one long directory, that's going to be fine for your users. Their URLs will be very short, but over time, you're going to have a tough time finding the files and keeping order in your own web server. Now, most of us, for most web publishing projects, do most of our work in static HTML. Most sites will use this mode of delivering information. You'll prepare information offline by hand or using some sort of authoring tool, and you'll post the information to the web server every time it's been updated. You might do this by hand using a file transfer protocol, or you might take advantage of one-button publishing, which is available in tools such as FrontPage, Netscape Composer, and other authoring environments. But some sites will want to go further than static HTML. They'll want to get into interactive or dynamic web pages. There's a couple of basic ways of doing this. Either the Common Gateway interface or a variety of database interfaces that we'll talk about. The Common Gateway interface is an old and venerable way to connect your web server off to some sort of external program. So what we have here is a user may have filled in a form that, say, allows them to join a mailing list or subscribe to some service, and that form has been sent back up to the web server, and the web server software is communicating over the rules of CGI to a special purpose program that somebody has written according to the rules of the Common Gateway interface. Now, CGI is really good for getting going and doing something very simple. It's probably not the best approach if you're going to get into a heavy, long-term, large-scale database kind of project. So you'll find that there are folks out there that know how to write CGI scripts and common languages such as Perl. You'll also find that there are archives available on the internet where you can go and get simple little CGI scripts to do work for you. But if you're going to get into databases in a big way, you may want to stay away from CGI and look at other alternatives. There's a variety of middleware products that are other ways to connect to a database. One popular tool is ColdFusion from the Alera Corporation. Using this tool, you write in the ColdFusion markup language, and really, you sort of embed little database code inside your HTML documents. Then you reference a database via that embedded code, for instance, using Access or an SQL server as the back end, and ColdFusion is talking to that database for you. An increasingly popular tool for connecting to a database is Microsoft's Active Server Pages, or ASP. Microsoft's ASP tool allows very intimate integration with the Microsoft Internet Information Server, or IIS, and it provides a scripting language called VBScript. Very easy to install and very easy to integrate. So whether you're going to do static HTML or whether you're going to get into fancy database kinds of applications, you're going to want to make some choices as to what tools need to be in your toolkit to get going as a web publisher. What do you think about that, Chuck?
Well, I mean, what you just talked about is roughly 2 years of learning before a person would be absolutely strong in all the areas that you described. And whether or not an organization chooses to run a web server depends on what they how they view that. Do they view that as a joy, a journey, or does that sound like drudgery to learn all that stuff? And I think that's the key question organizations have to ask. Are we looking forward to doing this, or are we afraid of doing this and we don't want to do it in the first place?
Now let's talk about what's involved in running your own server. First, we'll talk about the webmaster role versus the role of system administrator. Then we'll talk about choosing a hardware platform. And we'll talk about server software choices. Let's say you're going to be a server administrator. Well, actually, there are two roles encompassed by this term. One is the role of webmaster, and that's the person who's responsible for the web content and the maintenance of that content. A different role is the role of system administration. That's the person who installs the operating system software, the server software, and so forth, who worries about networking, security, backup, and so forth. Now, in smaller organizations, these roles are often accomplished by the same person. So let's say you're going to be embarking on picking a system. Well, what are your choices? Well, traditionally, an internet server has been some sort of a Unix machine, a server class Unix box. And this, quite frankly, is because the internet grew up under Unix. A Unix server may cost from $7,500 to $25,000 or more. And you can buy them from a variety of vendors, from Sun to Hewlett-Packard, IBM, and so forth. Now, one attractive option here is many hardware vendors will bundle web server software with their hardware in a special package. Take the server hardware out of the box, do a little bit of configuration, and you are ready to serve web pages. This can be a real boon. Now, at the low end, if you want to save some money, there are other options under Unix. You can go buy a garden variety Wintel or Intel PC, and that can be a wonderful low-cost platform. This can be a lot cheaper than buying proprietary Unix hardware. You can even run a free version of Unix on such a box. There's Linux, which is available over the internet and also in many bookstores, and there's FreeBSD. Both of these are complete Unix operating systems available for you to install on an Intel box. There are also commercial versions of Unix for Intel, such as UnixWare or SCO Unix. Now, in the Windows environment, you have some choices. You could pick the Windows NT operating system, and that's a real server class platform. It's rugged, robust, and high performance. You can find a variety of Netscape servers. Microsoft, of course, has a server for it. O'Reilly's Website Pro is available for it. One thing you'll want to note is that there's a couple of different versions of Windows NT, NT Workstation and NT Server, and you'll want to pick the right one based on your expected transaction load due to licensing reasons. Now, my recommendation is that you not consider Windows 95 or Windows 98 for an institutional server. Now, there are some pretty good personal web servers available for these environments, but I don't regard them as robust enough for institutional purposes. Other options might include the Macintosh. A number of folks who are enamored of the Mac operating system like to use it for this sort of purpose, and System 7 and later versions provide the necessary multitasking. You can also get some really nice plug-and-play servers for the Mac, such as WebStar. Setup is very easy, administration is very intuitive, but in practice you'll find that most high-visibility sites tend to go with a Unix or an NT environment for serving their very most popular web pages. Now let's say we need to worry about server software. Well, a lot of sites that are running under Unix will use a public domain or shareware Unix web server environment as well. And the most popular one turns out to be Apache. In fact, the majority of sites on the internet, on the web, using any environment use Apache. Apache is also very well suited to virtual host environments. So if you're going off and serving pages from a virtual host somewhere, there's a good chance Apache is the web server that's serving those pages. However, now it's the case that under the Windows NT environment, folks are beginning to look at commercial packages and NT as the solution that they might want. In the environment of commercial web servers, then, we have major players including Netscape, which has a variety of Netscape servers, their commerce server, their communication server, and their FastTrack server. Now, these are available for both Unix and NT operating system environments. And there are different flavors, variations on a theme here. For instance, the Commerce server is well suited to commercial applications thanks to its encryption capabilities. Microsoft, of course, has its Internet Information Server, or IIS, and this comes bundled with Windows NT. When you install NT, you've got a web server ready to roll. You'll find that IIS is also well suited to Microsoft Active Server pages and databases. And finally, there are other commercial server solutions. Now, let's say you've got that special hat on, you're the webmaster. You've got some particular duties you want to think about. One of these is log analysis, another is promoting your site, and then you're going to have to, in many cases, manage some extensions that will help you take care of your users, your content providers. For instance, FrontPage, a very popular authoring environment, has some extensions that are available under IIS and other servers. And you're going to want to work with your system administrator to get those extensions installed, and then you'll be involved in administering users, defining who can come in and what information they can poke where on your web hierarchy. Let's talk a little bit more about log analysis. With log analysis tools, you can learn more about your site. You can find out what pages are most popular, what are least popular. You can find out some dead links within your site. You can find out who visits your site. What domains are they coming from? What countries across the planet? Finally, you can find out how do people, in fact, encounter your site. What are the links that they follow to get to your site? And what are the keywords that they type into search engines to discover your site? There is a wide variety of log analysis tools out there. You can spend $100, you can spend $1,000, you can spend $10,000 on log analysis tools. This is a sample page out of a report from a very popular tool called Web Trends. And here we're looking at, by time of day, which directories on a given site are accessed most frequently. Site promotion. One of the most important things you can do is learn about and use the meta tags. Now, the meta tags have two forms. Meta keywords specify short words that people might be typing into search engines in order to find your site. If the words you put in your meta tag match what people type when they type into search engines, then they're more likely to find your site. The meta description tag allows you to give a short abstract defining what's on your page or on your site. And your abstract, which should be less than 100 words, will be shown as the result document in a search result set instead of getting the first 100 or so words randomly off a given page. You may also want to consider site promotion services. One of these is submitit.com. There you can go and specify your URL or starting point, and Submitit will go and register your site with all the popular search engines. You might also want to check out webpromote.com and its competitors. WebPromote will give you advice on promoting your site, and for a fee, you can ask them to go and do some professional work in along the lines of promoting that site. Chuck?
Well, I want to sort of go back to what you talked about at the very beginning, and that is that there are two roles. I mean, you just told us a good overview of what the web server role is, but the system administrator role is equally important, and I think the big challenge is in a small organization, when you have one person doing both things, you almost have to switch hats. You almost have to say, Tuesday, I'm going to be webmaster and kind of think arts and look and layout and what's the direction. And then on Wednesday, I'm going to look for security break-ins and log violations and all these various things. And so coming up next, we're going to talk about, you know, the administration side of things. But I think it's something people cannot do a real good job on one and ignore the other.
Good point.
Now we're going to talk about system administration, the other hat compared to being a webmaster. The topics we're going to cover are installation of the system, configuration after you've installed it, a little bit about security, talk a bit about the networking and how we set that up, and then we'll finish talking about backup. Installation. We've selected NT4.0 as the system we're going to talk about for these examples. If you buy a new system, you can specify that it comes with NT4.0. Now that's very good. It has the advantage that they've tested all the hardware and they know that it works with NT4.0. You still may want to start over absolutely from scratch and format the hard disk for experience. The problem is if you don't do that and 6 months later your system is down and you haven't been through that experience, then you might not be able to get it back up for a couple of weeks. So it doesn't hurt when the thing's not into production to just format it, because that's the easiest time to do it. 6 months later, when you're off the air, is the wrong time to learn how to do this. Our toolkit will show you a step-by-step approach to this installation, starting from absolute scratch, using the boot floppies, format the hard disk, and bring the whole thing back up. Installation challenges that you're going to see. NT is a little pickier about its hardware than, say, Windows 95 or Windows 98. There's a book called the NT Compatibility Guide. And you can look to see if the particular peripherals that you're purchasing are supported by NT before you buy those peripherals. Again, if you buy something from a company like Dell or Compaq that says this runs NT and you bought all the peripherals, then that's one way to roughly ensure that your equipment will work with NT. 95 and 98 have what's called plug and play. NT4.0 does not have plug and play, so you may have to be a little more aware of what the hardware settings for your different cards are. For example, there's an interrupt number, which is how the card signals the rest of the computer that it has some data. And this number is a small number, usually in the range of 3 to 15. The other number is the input address, which is a three-digit hexadecimal number, such as 2F0 or 300, which is an area where the card and the rest of the computer exchange data. The other thing that you'll have to get in are what's called device drivers. This is software that's specific to each piece of hardware. And these generally come on little floppy disks that come in the box with the hardware. And so you may have to install several small pieces of software called device drivers from floppy disks, just like this. This is a rough outline of the installation. First, you take the boot floppies, the NT boot floppies, boot the system up. There are three of them for NT4.0. Then you will partition and format the hard disk. And that will copy a small amount of information onto the hard disk. And then you reboot from the hard disk. And then NT continues its installation, copying all its materials from the CD-ROM. And there are sometimes several reboots in this process as you install software and configure it. And if you get a recent version of NT4.0, it will actually install the Internet Information Server as a side effect of this process. Once you've brought the system up, the thing that you'll run into are typically configuration errors, like it hasn't been able to talk to your network card. You'll get to be really good friends with what's called the event log. And this is under Start, Program, Common Administration Tools, Event Log. And what this shows is all the things that went wrong on the way up in the system. And you can be proud of yourself when you finally got to the point where you can bring the system all the way up from scratch and everything works and you check this log and nothing has happened in the log, and then you know that you're in good shape. Once the hardware is configured, and NT sort of is talking to the hardware, you'll configure things like the networking and the other operating system software. So you'll need the IP address and the net mask and the gateway and those other things. These are generally much easier to do and less problematic than getting the hardware basically working. Of course, the network settings will be different for each location. Security is a very, very important part of a system administrator's job. In a sense, if someone breaks in, you're supposed to take that very personally, as if that's sort of a failure in some way. Hackers are going to be drawn to a site such as a small organization because they're going to assume that the administrator is not going to be watching very closely and that you'll have silly passwords that they can break into very easily. Here's a few general approaches. Don't put a bunch of accounts on these systems. Keep the number of accounts very low. Log everything every account does. You shouldn't have 200 people a day logging into this web server. So you log every single thing that goes on so you can look at it. And disallow on repeated attempts. So if someone's trying, has forgotten their password, shut them off quick. Don't like say, okay, you can have 200 attempts. Because that way people can just try to keep logging in and trying to guess people's passwords. You got to keep the whole server arrangement simple. Installing a piece of software may actually add a security hole that you didn't even know. You pull some funny thing off the web or a game or something, and you may be putting a security hole in your server that you don't even know about. So keep things simple. The other thing is look at those logs at least weekly. You'll get used to what's going on, and then maybe that particular hacker will jump out at you and you'll catch it before everything goes awry. Another role that you have is creating user accounts. You have various people. You'll have people inside your organization and outside that you're going to be authorizing to put web content up. Don't ever allow account sharing. And then be very, very paranoid. And don't be afraid to turn the account off and make a phone call before you turn the account back on. NT provides very simple and straightforward tools for creating and configuring these user accounts. Backup is a very important part of your role as a system administrator. Do not assume that hard drives, even though they have a 5-year warranty, that they'll never fail. If you think about it, a failure of a hard drive, you can lose months or years of work. And I don't know if you're the same as me, but once you lose work that you've already done, it is almost the most frustrating thing that you can imagine. And this could be work that has many contributors. And in the case of, say, a library, this may be work that cannot be reproduced. It was captured and now it's absolutely gone. So the typical backup strategy is to take a daily, weekly, and monthly approach to backup. Each day you back up the material that's changed during that day, and often that's a very small amount of information. Sometimes people even back that up to a disk rather than to a tape, a disk on a different server. Every week you back the entire set of files up on the system, and then again every month back up a set, all the files on the system. And what you do is you have pools of tapes that you rotate, the daily tapes, the weekly tapes, and the monthly tapes. So you may have 12 monthly tapes and 4 weekly tapes and 14 daily tapes, and you just keep rotating. Now, so you back the material up, but what if there's a fire that destroys the backup tapes? Now, what people often say, well, there's not going to be a fire, it's a concrete room. Well, what if the place next door has a fire and they kick in your door or the water comes in? There's all kinds of ways that your material can get lost. So you need some way to store your material off-site. Your server can be destroyed, your tapes can be destroyed, so you need to take your full dumps off-site. Once a month is a good idea. You could have 3 or 4 off-site backups that are a few months old and get them off-site. A safe deposit box is an inexpensive place off-site to put them. In terms of backup options, you have several choices of media. The typical choice is DAT, or digital audio tape. The largest of DAT currently holds 12 or 24 gigabytes compressed. The tape drive costs about $1,500, and each tape costs up to $40. Now, you can also buy a lowered volume tape for a lower price than that. Another tape media that's commonly used is called Trevon. The tapes currently hold up to about 8 gigabytes. The drives are less expensive, but the tapes are also about $40. NT comes with basic backup software that's suitable for standalone systems so that you can back your web server up and your web data up and then restore it. this software is typically not sufficient if you're trying to run an entire NT network and back up all the clients. You're going to need some additional tools. There's many commercial products, and they do a pretty good job. They schedule the backup, they catalog the backup, they start the backup late at night, and an example product of such a thing is called ArcServe. Rich, any comments?
Well, we've heard a lot today about what's involved in administering a system, being a webmaster, being a system administrator, but maybe the best way to learn is to hear it from somebody who does it for a living. So we're going to go now to Larry Neal, who's the head of technical systems for the Rochester Hills Public Library, and learn a little bit about being a system administrator.
Libraries have so many great resources to get information. We're not competing with each other as the commercial world is. It's easy nowadays to get on a listserv, to call up a few other libraries that you know are working on similar projects and asking, who did the work for you? How happy were you with their work? Even to the point of saying, can I have a copy of your request for proposal? Most libraries that I've encountered are very willing to share advice. Cabling can be a really great thing or a really horrible thing. And even though it might seem simple just to string it down like a piece of yarn through whatever, you really do want somebody who has the skills and knowledge as to how that cable should be run. If cabling is pulled right, it can be something that can sit there for years and not cause you a bit of problem. If it's not pulled correctly, every time somebody flips on a row of a bank of lights in a room and all of a sudden you're not able to access your network server, that you're going to spend a lot more time trying to troubleshoot the problems later on than having it done right by somebody who is familiar with cable. PCs and servers are, libraries are not going to have fewer of them, they're going to have increasingly more of these systems. So you have to decide, do I have the resources to have somebody on my staff become the expert in maintaining and running those? So you'll have to look at what the cost of an outside vendor is to do that versus having somebody on your staff. I don't like having to come back in and trying to fix something that somebody else has created. I want to know how it was set up if I'm going to have to be the maintainer of the system. So I think either you find a turnkey system, or if it's for a system such as a LAN server that I don't want to spend all that money to have maintained by an outside company and I have enough need to know how it all goes together, that's something that I want to learn and have knowledge on how to maintain. On a typical week, I'll back up on a Friday. If something unusual has been going on where we've been creating something that has taken a lot of time, or I am aware of something in particular that would be very difficult to lose, then I'll back it up more frequently, and also a tape backup that's then taken off site in case of the worst situation where something happened to the building or at least to that computer room. And then the other thing that I check every couple of days is in an NT server environment, they have what's called an event log, and the event log can audit whatever types of activities you wish to audit. So if somebody tries to log in and they type an incorrect password, that would be called a failure type event, and so then the machine would keep track of that. And you can keep track of success events where somebody logs in and you know what time they were successfully logged onto the network. And I just keep an eye on how often people are trying to get into a certain account and their password is not working. I run a relatively paranoid network. People have 5 opportunities to type in their password into an account, and if they don't make it within 5 logins, then it locks the account for the day, and that normally gives me enough time to find out. Generally what happens is the person calls me and says that they can't get in any longer because they've been locked out. People have access 24 hours a day when an account is created. So one of the first things that I do is I look at what our typical work schedule is, and I immediately eliminate the periods of time, such as 10 o'clock p.m. until 7 a.m., that people can get into an account. So I'm checking the event log just to see what's been happening to that server. And then I also find that rebooting the servers every couple of weeks, even though everything should run perfectly and there should be no memory leaks, just restarting the servers to make sure that everything shuts down all right and starts back up again.
Thanks, Larry, for those insights. So, Chuck, what do you think? After seeing that video, do you think people are going to want to install their own server?
You know, I think that some will, and I think that some won't. And what I hope is by watching this, the right folks are going to put up the servers that should put up the servers, and perhaps even more importantly, those people who shouldn't put up servers won't put up servers. But all in all, I'm really looking forward to the neat material that's going to come out of this kind of effort.
That's great. And we'll see you on the net.